Hey there, everybody. This is co-host Robert. What you are listening to is a rebroadcast of Forgot My Dice episode 15, titled Hey Dog, I Heard You Like Landmines, where we reviewed the Arcadia Quest spinoff, Mass Mora. As always, the content is a year old and covers topics and news that have long since happened. But feel free to check out the show notes on ForgotMyDice.com and join us in the Forgot My Dice fans Facebook group. And coming soon, the first episode of the JRPG Book Club. So start playing Dragon Quest 1.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Welcome to another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. I'm Jonathan Edwards, your host, and across from me, as always, the rising sun to my blood rage, Mr. Robert Lundgren. How are you doing?
Hello, hello.
Somehow I've managed to crack both blood rage and rising sun into the same reference within 30 seconds of the beginning of the show.
I've got that cool dragon and Godzilla because I'm the rising sun, so I got those cooler models, so I'm okay with that.
As always, let's go ahead and get the show started today with our off-the-shelf segment. In this segment, we talk about all the things that we've been getting off the shelf to read, to play, and to have fun with. And Robert, let's...
Not so much play lately. We haven't been playing a lot of games lately.
Yeah. It's been a little off this last couple weeks, but that's okay. Still got a couple things off, so let's start out with you, Robert. What have you been up to in the reading department? Because I see some things here on the list.
Okay, well, first off, I found this website a while ago, and I tweeted it out, like, I think over a month ago. But I want to give a shout-out to onepagerules.com.
Very cool website.
Very cool website. So, basically, what they do is it's... I don't know if it's a guy, if it's a couple of guys, if I don't know who it is or what, but basically they take existing properties and then they make a sort of a streamlined, shortened one page rules variant of it. And then they publish it on the website. And so they can't actually use any trademark names, but they've got games like called Grim Dark, which, you know,
gosh, what could that be?
Warhammer 40K. And, you know, they have one called Double Tap, which is loosely based off of Infinity. They've got, you know, stuff based off of Age of Sigmar. There's just a lot of weird little rules variants there. And they're fun. They're just tight little rules variants. And it made me kind of, since I had dusted off my Relic Knights figures, I'm like, oh, hey, maybe we could test the Infinity variant or something with my Relic Knights.
So, there you go.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's a fun little website, and what's really fun is every so often I get this, like, urge to, like, read a new rule system, and usually my wife hates that because, you know, that usually comes along with a $20 to $50 price tag of me buying something. But I just go to this website, and I usually just kind of get my fix real quick. It's just like, oh, yeah, that'll do me for a couple days. Yeah, I'm good. OnePageRules.com. I'll have a link there. It's fun stuff. So I've been reading a lot. Do you have anything you want to talk about reading, or should I just shotgun through all my stuff?
I've been working through the third Dresden book. I'm in the process of rereading them all. Talking about the card game kind of got me back in that swing of things. And I've also got that Eberron rule set that you gave me, just sitting there waiting. I have paged through it several times, and I like everything I've seen.
Yeah, everything really you said about Kaladesh, about I was like, yeah, you'd probably like Eberron.
No, Eberron looks amazing.
Yes, I can't wait till you read it, because then we can talk about... Because it's supposed to be kind of like Indiana Jones, the fantasy game, so we can talk about the discussion I've had with many a people, who are the Nazis?
I'm also flirting with the idea of working through the Dark Tower series again, because the movie's coming out, and I keep hearing about it, and so now I just kind of want to read the books again.
Jonathan, I got a challenge for you, buddy. Okay, stop putting together your mini.
No, I can't. This is good for me. It helps me concentrate. I need to fiddle with things.
So Jonathan has been falling deeper into the rabbit hole of Blood Bowl. He went and bought himself the ogre?
The ogre.
That works for both the humans and... works for the
this ogre will only be working for the humans, good sir, I assure you. So as we continue our prep to our Blood Bowl review, we are prepping our
which
minis.
Will take 12 years at this point, because now you're buying more crap to paint.
One model model. You're making it seem like I've bought an armada of players. This one guy.
Well, now you've
it's
got
just one guy.
You had 12, now you have 13 things to paint, man. It just grows. That's how they get you.
No, it'll be fine. But yes, as we continue down our prep for the Blood Bowl review, path. We have constructed all of our models, and now I am building my very, very first expansion model, and it is the Ogre, and he's actually kind of neat looking. You and I have been kind of looking at him all night.
Yeah, I've been looking at him. I'm like, do I need to do anything to orc him up a little bit for my greenskin army? Or greenskin army, my greenskin team? Probably not, but I might think of something. I got Plasticard. I can give him some more random plates, because orcs like just random plates.
Yeah, it would definitely make him fit with everybody else.
Anyway, let's circle this wagon train back to what we were talking about. So you've been reading the third novel of the Dresden books.
Yes. I got to say, from the early stuff, it's one of my favorites. I absolutely love it. Yeah, it's Grave Peril.
Is that the first time the Paladin shows up?
Yeah, it's the first time Michael shows up.
Yes.
And, you know, it's funny because I've been playing some of the, kind of just a segue into games. I've been playing some of the
Dresden Files
card game, and I've been choosing Michael a lot because he's a great character, and so it was kind of...
Of course he's a great character. He's a paladin. Word to the wise, MMOs, role-playing games, anything, play the paladin.
So, yes,
just saying.
Just on a side note, we are, of course, deep diving into Mass Mora later in this episode, and Robert had me diving through all of my Arcadia Quest stuff, finding the paladin for him to play with. So
which is funny, because we had one like right in front of us. But
which
we just,
neither one of us realized.
Right, yeah, but there's three to pick from. I think I picked the wrong one, actually. I was looking all three of them. I like the dwarf the best. But anyway, that we'll get to that later. So okay. I got my, I tweeted this out, a picture of it, which I found out my camera was smudged on my iPad when I took this picture. So I probably have to do it again, because it's kind of got that hazy dreamlike blur on it.
Probably. Although that is rather appropriate for that book, to be fair.
Probably a baby print. But I got my Blue Rose Kickstarter in. I sprung for the special edition.
That is a beautiful book, by the way.
Yeah. So Blue Rose is a fantasy setting by Green Ronin Games. And it's...
Who make also what?
Mutants and Masterminds. They make the Dragon Age RPG. They make, actually, the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game is theirs.
Yeah, there you go.
It uses the same system as Dragon Age and Fantasy Age.
Which is a good system.
Titan's Grave, yeah. Fantasy Age, I like it.
Yeah, I like Titan's Grave, I like Dragon Age.
Here's the thing. Whenever I get a new fantasy system, or whenever I look at one, I ask myself, why should I play this when I could be playing D&D? And usually the answer is, there's no reason to, and I don't play it. And Fantasy Age, I look at it, and, like, of its all of its individual pieces, like, I don't, that thing doesn't trigger with me. I'm like, there's no, I shouldn't play it, but like, I'm oddly fascinated by the system and I still want to play it anyway. And I don't understand it. Like, I've been trying to articulate to people why I like the system so much, and I can't put a finger on it.
Yeah.
It's
interesting, because last night, as I was looking through the book, I was basically trying to figure out why it was that you were so interested in it. Not that there's anything wrong with the book. The book is absolutely gorgeous, but yeah, it's basically just an offshoot of D&D. I haven't seen you that excited about something in a while.
I know, it's bizarre. I don't know what it is about the age system, but I really enjoy it. Dragon Age was great. Anyway, so Blue Rose is basically, instead of like Tolkien or, you know, high fantasy that we're used to with murder hoboing, this goes to the subgenre they call romantic fantasy, which is, you know, your Mercedes Lackey is probably the biggest name in that. You know, it's a little bit more about groups and, I don't know, basically think of a plotline of every JRPG ever, where you're a loner and you join a group and then you slowly learn to become part of that group and become part of their weird extended family. Like every Final Fantasy game has been kind of that trope.
Yeah.
Thank you, Squall. Thank you, Cloud. It looks fun. I'm actually kind of excited to run it one day. I don't think that day will be anytime soon, but now I've got a pretty, pretty giant book.
It is. So from a production quality standpoint, that is a sublime volume. Did it come with a book jacket?
No. This is the leather cover. So the normal one will look more like a normal D&D book. The picture that's on the inside cover will be on the outside.
It's a beautiful book. It's like Robert was just saying, it's leather, a leather cover. But then they've even got the gold foil leaf on the edges of the pages, which looks beautiful, and a built-in bookmark. I mean, it's a class act. And the art inside is just striking.
Yeah, really the lady nice. Who does the cover image.
That cover image is just amazing.
Yeah, she's actually on Facebook, so she posts stuff she's working on fairly frequently, which is kind of fun. Her name's Stephanie Law. I'll put a link to her Facebook page, I guess, in the show notes. But yeah, she works in watercolors, and her stuff has this really kind of airy, dreamy fairy tale vibe.
It's also got, it harkens back kind of, I don't know what the era was, but you know the tapestries that they used to do in medieval times?
Yeah.
It has that feeling while still being very modern.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, kind of two-dimensional.
Yeah. Robert's going to put a link to some pictures in the show notes so that you kind of get a sense of what we're talking about. But I think, you know, once you see it, you'll kind of get what we mean, because it's very striking. It's a beautiful style.
Yeah, her art's just
very
gorgeous.
Mild colors.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she works in watercolors. That's kind of how it works.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, and it's cool because on her Facebook page she posts works in progress and what she's working on. It's cool to watch. So shifting gears, like a record scratch. So my writing partner, he has this bizarre love for this game that came out in 1997.
Oh God, this.
And
so let me preface this discussion as saying that Robert brings this book over last night.
Yeah.
after a string of 20 different text messages. Yeah. About how 90s it was,
How insane it is,
and
so it's like go on, sorry.
No, I was just gonna say I will start this off by saying that this is perhaps the oddest RPG book I have ever looked at. It's like heavy metal took a time travel to the 90s and, got a dose of Silverhawk, if you remember that cartoon. And it's just, I don't even know where else to go with it. I mean, it's just so random.
So it's the game's called Waste World. It came out in 1997. Got a few supplements back in the day, and then it quietly folded. It was originally a European game. I forget which country it's originally from. Probably.
Something tells me one of the Nordic countries.
Yeah, no, Sweden's really big into role-playing games. But yeah, and it's kind of like the idea was, so Rifts came out in 91. And so I think what they did was they kind of made a list of every trope that Rifts didn't kind of touch on. So like Dune and Terminator and like 70s album covers.
The spice must flow.
Yeah.
Man.
And Mad Max. And anyway, they got like a list of things that didn't feel were covered in the base Rifts game. And then they made kind of a kitchen sink setting out of that. And it's so bizarre.
What's crazy about it is just how detailed the fluff is. somebody really spent a lot of time thinking this puppy through.
So it takes place on an alien planet that's kind of a deserty Mad Maxy world. I think complete with sandworms. It's totally not Arrakis. And I forget what it's actually called, but it's got a goofy name.
I believe that's the name of the planet, right? Totally not Arrakis.
Totally not Arrakis, yeah. And basically, a while ago in the setting, the planet got quarantined because this apocalypse virus got released. And what it did was it turned all the robots into man-killing monsters.
What? That never happened.
Yeah, so you got your killbots. They look like every killbot ever. There's a lot of different variations on the killbot that are still roaming the wasteland. And so everybody like bottled themselves up into these cities. And the best part is, you know how if something's really cool, you spell it with an X or end it with a Z?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no. This one like got way ahead of that curve. And now anytime you spell a word with a C in it, you replace that with a K. So there's Icarus, but it's spelled with a K.
So they were obviously looking at the Mortal Kombat playbook.
Yes, yes.
Which is age appropriate considering publication time.
Yeah, yeah, actually. Very true, very true. And so there's like a flying city where they're basically pirates, but instead of flying down and flying ships, because I guess that's current because the Killdan overlords, but whatever. That's so last year. No. They have winged suits with like freaking razor blades because there's a piece of armor
that looks like the Silverhawk suit.
Yes! And they're chrome because why not? And they fly down. And where like Games Workshop has a weird fascination with chainsaws, this game has a weird fascination with buzzsaws.
Yeah, I like that gauntlet that you showed me.
Yeah, so yeah, instead over your knuckles is like a small buzzsaw, so when you punch someone the buzzsaw fires up and you shred them.
I don't even want to go into the difficulty of trying to design something like that, because in the picture it's very clear that they haven't thought out that the buzzsaw is 360 degrees, so it's gotta go someplace, you know, when it spins.
And then they have this thing called the Mega Mace, because throw Mega in front of anything and it's automatically more awesome.
Oh, duh.
And basically it's a stick with a like an old time. I mean, think of a naval landmine from every cartoon you've ever seen.
Like the beginning of that one James Bond movie?
Yeah, or in Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those on a stick, and basically when you hit somebody with it, one of the spikes will just shoot off into somebody and cause extra damage. And then not to be outdone, somebody put like five of those bad boys on chains, attach it to a motor.
Yeah, I believe that was Exhibit.
and then started
pimp my mace.
Yeah, and then started beating up people with it.
Hey dog, I heard you like landmines, so I put landmines on my mace so that it can spin while you die.
So there's some, there's these different cities that all have their different vibes. There's the, kind of the kitchen sink city where the Crocs, of course, K-R-O-Ks, hang out with the other people. And they're space aliens.
It's so ridiculous.
That kind of look like velociraptors with T-Rex heads. And they have guns because why not?
But then they've got manly, beefy human arms.
Yes!
Don't forget that part because that's the important part.
And the Mega Mace warhead, they attach them to their tails.
Yeah.
And that's where they came from.
They're bipedal, so they're like raptors, except instead of having the little raptor arms, they've got these giant beefy Schwarzenegger arms.
Yep. And there's Cthulhu faced aliens and the whole nine. And then there's the Shogunate, which is like every bad anime trope, like just mashed together. And then you add lightsabers for seasoning. Yeah. It's so good.
It's very apparent that this came out right when anime was getting big in the United States because
or Sweden or wherever it came from.
Oh, I just don't even know what to say about this system. It's so awesome. If it weren't so bad, it would just be terrible. But it's so bad that it goes right around the dial again, back to awesome.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm reading it, and you're just reading it, and you're just like, it's palm face, like, all the time when you're reading this. But there's something just entertainingly awesome about the whole show that's just amazing. So, anyway, it's called Waste World. It's long out of print. Good luck finding it. but if it sounds interesting, I'll try to find somebody who's selling it. My writing partner found it on Amazon, I think. And I, honestly,
if you have half price books in your area, it's always worth a trip into the RPG section because occasionally you will see some trippy, odd, weird stuff.
Yeah, I saw Waste World actually at one not all that long, and I that was like about a week before my friend told me, my writing partner told me, it's like, yeah, I really like this game. I'm like, oh, I should have bought it for you. And then I went back about 3 weeks later and it was gone. I'm like, oh, I could have gone.
Because how could a gem like that not be gone?
I know. All right, enough about 1997. Okay, I gotta do it. Okay, so I've been reading more Powers of Darkness. If you want to hear more about this book, the short story is some dude in Iceland rewrote Dracula into Icelandic, and then now somebody has translated this rewritten Dracula back into English. The plot points are very, very dissimilar, and I got done, because I read it in short little spurts. I got done with his name's Joshua, by the way, not Jonathan Harker.
No, Joshua can't be Jonathan.
Right, Joshua Harker. I got through him hanging out at the castle, and it's just a little different. While Jonathan's exploring the castle, he goes into the basement, and Dracula has apparently mutant ape men that work for him. And he leads them in a satanic blood sacrifice.
This is like a 12-year-old.
I know.
Like, literally, this is like somebody was sitting around middle school and was like, hey, I just read that Dracula thing, you know, for school, but I can make it so much better.
And then the thing that actually is throwing me off now is they've shifted away from the castle. They've gone to the Lucy Wilhelmina story, which is now Wilma and Lucia.
Wilma.
Yeah. And they've shifted to their story and about the Demeter and about the ship crashing and then the boxes of Earth and basically Dracula's trip to England. And it's really short. Like, they blow through that whole part of the story really, really fast. But it shifts from Joshua writing in his journal to just like a novel format, like out of nowhere. And I'm like, what happened? Like, that was kind of the draw of Dracula. It's like it really happened, air quotes. And now we're just at like some dude, like, it's like, yeah, this is a novel now. And it's like, but it wasn't a novel earlier. What's going on? So, Powers of Darkness, still an entertaining read. We'll see if it gets better. I got the sense that it's shifted.
Something tells me that the answer to that is no, Robert.
I'll keep reading it and reporting back. All right, let's move in.
I'm starting to question your reading habits. I mean,
I read Knights Black Agents, the Dracula dossier. Come on. I had my head. I watched every Hammer horror movie on Dracula.
I try and go back and forth. For every piece of pulpy fiction fun that I read, I like to read either classic or a nonfiction book. So
this is kind of all of those wrapped up in one.
No, it is not. That is not a true statement, sir.
All right. So let's shift gears. Video games.
Sure. Well, I mean, let's get the big, you know, 900-pound gorilla out of the way.
Yeah, I've been playing more Overwatch, and I switched to Roadhog, and I picked the skin that makes me look like Maui from Moana.
Stop trying to convince me that that's not that's the 900-pound gorilla. So since the last episode, Mass Effect Andromeda has been released.
Yes.
So it's now been a week since Andromeda was released.
I'm so tired.
In fact, I recall last Monday, you and I had chatted, and then at midnight was the release.
11. It was 11 our time.
11 our time, yeah. How many hours have you put in since then?
I checked this morning. I've put in 43 hours and 58 minutes.
You have a problem.
I have a problem.
You need therapy.
I don't know what it is about BioWare games, but the 20-year-old Robert comes out, and I'll know the day I've truly become old when I just can't do this anymore, and that day's coming because this is killing me. But I just don't sleep, and I play that game and just this explosion of mania until I finish it, and I'm 43.
So it should be said that I, too, have purchased Mass Effect Andromeda, and I'm currently 4 hours in.
I haven't slept. I'm functioning off of beer caffeine right now.
So
I sleep about 2 to 4 hours a night right now.
With no details whatsoever on plot, because I do not want spoilers.
Okay.
What are your initial thoughts?
Okay, I'm about to say something negative, so I'm going to preface this with, I'm enjoying the game, and I'll explain why. But
as am I. I'm enjoying the game as well.
Okay, so...
because I've got some negative thoughts as well.
Overall, I am finding the experience somewhat disappointing. Basically, what it feels like to me is it feels like Dragon Age Inquisition in space. It feels very, very, very similar to me, like that game. And it, the disappointing part...
it's missing the Mass Effect magic. I don't know how
I don't even... I'm 40 hours in. It's still there, I assure you. Dragon Age Inquisition came out after Skyrim, and the BioWare people said they paid attention to Skyrim. They liked some of the ideas of Skyrim. That's why Dragon Age Inquisition shifted from the smaller areas that you would run around to into the Frostbite engine, where they could render very large areas. Yeah. That you had a lot of side quests and stuff you could do, because I mean, like, and give it a lot of those side quests were dumb. It's like, go look at like five of these things or go collect 10 plants. But then again, that's what you did in Skyrim too. There were really dumb side quests in there too.
Yeah.
So the problem is, since that game came out, we've had The Witcher 3, and The Witcher 3 side quests were actually really good.
Yeah. I mean, there's side quests in The Witcher 3 that have that are better written and have more emotional impact than entire other RPGs I've played.
Exactly. And that's the problem, because Mass Effect Andromeda feels very much like Dragon Age Inquisition. Here's the thing. I like Dragon Age Inquisition. I liked it quite a bit. I played it through twice.
But you played it before Witcher 3.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Right, they didn't iterate on it. And that's what's disappointing. It's like it's 3 years ago when I think it's 3 years ago when Dragon Age Inquisition came out.
Yes.
And so they haven't iterated on anything. It's very much that vibe. And I like that vibe. I enjoyed that vibe. I'm having fun with that vibe. Don't get me wrong. If you like Dragon Age Inquisition and you want to play more Dragon Age Inquisition in space, like, this game will do it for you. It's very good at that.
Yep.
But the side quests are kind of dumb. And the side quests are also very inconsistent, because some of the story, like, good things for the story, like, you know, like loyalty missions.
Yeah.
They get started with just random crap. You know, it's like, hey, go scan something. And you're like, okay. And then you go scan it, and all of a sudden it, like, sort of whisks you away and do something kind of cool and awesome. But the problem is, for every quest like that, there's also a quest which is, go scan something. Oh, thanks for scanning that for me. Here's a gun. On your merry way. And that's my problem with the game. They did not iterate on anything. It didn't improve on a model that they already succeeded in doing 3 years ago.
To be fair to this game, it is definitely a game in the BioWare tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that is both a good thing and a bad thing.
It's a blessing and a curse.
On the one hand, we have a really solidly put together BioWare game with some questionable choices. My personal experience so far, just getting through the very beginning of it, is that the graphics are somewhat disappointing, especially the faces and...
Yeah, the complaints about animations are valid for the most part.
No, very much so. And
that's the thing. Dragon Age Inquisition had better animations.
They did. And every other game that I've ever seen in the Frostbite engine looks better than this. It's kind of inexplicable. It just doesn't feel like it was tuned well.
I read a guy who does this for a living. He actually wrote an article about it. I think it was on IGN. I'll put it in the show notes if I can find it again. He said that there's like an algorithm they use to do this, because sometimes they'll do it manually for like important sequences. But because RPGs, like, this isn't like
there's
Uncharted.
So many side characters.
There's so many side characters and side quests, you can't physically just do that with
that
everything.
That makes sense.
So
that
they have, like,
sense.
An algorithm, and he thinks what happened is the algorithm got set a little low, and it might just be that they just have to rev it up a little bit. So
the game feels rushed from a graphical standpoint.
Which is weird. I know they've been working on it for 3.5 years.
I love the way the game handles. Like, it handles
exquisitely.
Oh, the
combat's fun.
Yeah, the combat is super fun.
Super fun.
I mean, it takes the speed of Mass Effect 3 and adds a three-dimensional element by giving you those jump jets. And it's just, it's great. It's liquid fast. It's super fun. And I'm having a great time.
And I've seen people complain about it, that they took out the classes. I like that they took out the classes because, you know, if you really want to, like, spread your love out and be, you know, combat-y guy plus tech guy plus biotic guy, I mean, you can have all three suites in this game, which was not...
It's not like there's not multi-classing in every RPG system.
Well, yeah, and this is more of a point-based one. I'm totally okay with this. It's a completely point-based one. They just have three, like, skill trees that are very deep, that are very, very deep.
I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that actually works for me quite well.
Yeah So I like the mechanically the game plays very well. Yes. I'll give it that too, like but again, it's very similar to the combat in Dragon Age Inquisition.
Now that said, I do have to say that at least in the prologue, the first 4 hours of the game, there is some lazy writing, and I'm hoping that it improves, because one of the hallmarks of the Mass Effect series has always been the writing for me.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of Act 2. I am starting to get answers to questions, but I'm not getting them all yet. And I know what you mean, because like the first 10 or 15 hours, anytime I resolved anything, I didn't get an answer. I just got more questions. It was like watching Lost.
Yeah. Well, it's not even just a matter of the questions. It's a matter of the characterizations, too. I remember after interacting with Jack in 2 and 3, you know, as the backstory starts to come out, the emotional impact that had on me.
I'll agree with you.
This is just, it's lacking the impact. Well, it's all very cookie cutter.
With the game that I had too is, spoiler alert, when you get to the
no spoilers.
When you get to the Nexus, the amount of time that the Nexus was there, considering what they talked about happened between the time that you get there and the Nexus got there, I was like, there is no way that all of this happened in 14 months. Like, a lot happens in that 14 months. And when you go into the wider universe, like there's stuff that's gone on. I'm like, how did this happen in 14 months? And I really wish the game had made it more like 10 years.
Yeah.
Because then a lot of the stuff that happened, you know, I could more believably buy. But, like, it's getting better. But then again, you know, I'm also invested 43 hours of my life into it at this point. I might have drank the Kool-Aid, so I don't know. But I will say it's getting better. Like, Ryder's starting to grow on me. He is not Shepard. He's a kid. And he's a kid who kind of barely knows what he's doing. Shepard started a hero. He started very, very skilled because, you know, he was already through the special forces training. He was becoming a Spectre, which was a big deal. Ryder was like a guard on a know-nothing station who got drummed out of the military because people didn't like his dad. He's not a big deal. Yeah. So, you know, him being a little flat and sort of growing into this role of a big damn hero, I get, and it's happening as I'm watching it, but I think that's part of it too. Like, a lot of people use this as, you know, power fantasy, and Ryder's not a powerful guy at the beginning of it at all. He's just kind of this kid who barely knows what he's doing.
And I don't have a problem with that at all. I found to be quite refreshing. It's just the emotional impact and the emotional complexity that I've come to expect from a Mass Effect game has so far not been there.
I could agree with that.
All right. So
the combat is fun as hell.
Yeah. It's
fast. And I've still invested 43 hours of my life into this game, so it's obviously still got something going for me. Now, that might be a misnomer, by the way, because sometimes I have to leave people in long, awkward conversations, like where we're mid-conversation and I just haven't chosen an option because I have to go do something, and it sits like that for like 15, 20 minutes. So I don't know if I've actually played 43 hours.
Oh, okay, so even if we take 10 of that away, that's still 30 plus hours in a single week.
Yeah, and most of the time I do.
Of video gaming.
I mean, my kids are in bed, so that doesn't really mean anything. I'm awful.
All right, so we will keep you up to date as we progress through that, see how we like it. But let's go ahead and move on. And let's see. For me, it's been Mass Effect and a lot more Battlefield 1. The first expansion came out.
Ooh.
New maps, always fun. And a new game mode, which is kind of neat because it kind of combines aspects of Conquest and aspects of Rush, and it has this push-pull battlefield, which is kind of cool, where you take a point and then you have to take a point another point several yards forward, but if the other team takes it first, then you get pushed back, and you get this great back and forth fighting over points. And then, you know, finally, if you build enough momentum, you have to go set charges on these telegraphs, and that's how you end a match.
It's just like a trench war thing?
Yeah, kind of.
Nice.
I've been impressed with Battlefield 1 since launch, and it just keeps getting better. And the tweaks that they're making to the damage models are really, really good, and I'm just having a blast with that game. And then finally, I picked up Halo Wars 2, and I've barely touched it. It's gorgeous. Great cutscenes. I can't wait to dig into it more.
before I made my poor wife a Mass Effect widow. Thank you, Gina. We were watching Iron Fist. Speaking of disappointing things. Yeah,
I've not heard very much positive about it.
I think the internet hate machine's being a little harsh on the show from what I've seen so far. But I will say it's the worst one by far.
That's a pity.
It's the Netflix show, it's the weakest one. The problem is, like, the side characters are really interesting, especially Colleen Wing. I've actually want to know more about her character than I do about Danny Rand. But Danny Rand, I read a review, and I completely agree with it. Danny Rand is that guy you knew in high school who took a trip to, you know, Asia, India, somewhere in there, which was, quote-unquote, really spiritual for him, and came back, you know, talking about chakras and all these things, and is just really annoying. And yes, that is Danny Rand. I found out in the comics, Misty Knight from Luke Cage, the cop.
Yeah.
And Colleen Wing, who's this, you know, martial artist who has a sword and is kind of awesome. They teamed up eventually in the comics and opened up a private detective agency. I'm like, I want to watch that show.
Yeah, no kidding. Misty Knight is a great character.
Yeah, can you imagine her, like, you know, like doing like a 70s buddy cop show with like a female martial artist and her like shooting people with a gun? Oh, it'd be great.
You know, to be absolutely fair to the show, the bar was set pretty friggin' ridiculously high. I mean,
like, oh yeah,
Daredevil season 1 and 2 are just nothing short of perfection.
I'll disagree about season 2, but we can move on.
I really enjoyed season 2.
Season 2 lost its thesis for me because it became who's right, the Daredevil or the Punisher, and then they never bothered to answer that question because they wussed out on it. They kind of just went, they're both right.
I think they left it somewhat open for expansion purposes. I do believe that that's about,
you know, future. But if I'm going to give you 14 hours of my life, you can answer the question that you raised at the beginning of it. That's my response to that.
I think that the Jessica Jones takes the superhero show in a completely different direction, which was felt fresh and fun. And man, David Tennant was so good in that.
Yeah, super creepy.
And then finally you get Luke Cage, which is like this love letter to 70s cop shows and Harlem in general. And just like you've got these three completely beautifully put together shows, so it's okay that they have a miss. You know, I
think its greatest sin is in the comics. Danny Rand and Luke Cage are like real good buddies. Like they had a comic together for a long time, and the way that they have Danny Rand and the way they have Luke Cage on the show, I do not buy that these two guys would hang out. Except they probably do have a mutual love of hip hop because Danny Rand listens to a lot of hip hop.
Well, there you go.
But other than that, I don't know why those two would hang out. And
we'll see where it goes.
We'll see where it goes.
I haven't had a chance to watch it.
I'm only 5 episodes in, so, and like I said, I do think the internet hate machine's been a little harsh on it, but it is the weaker of the shows. So,
all right. So I know, Robert, that the board gaming component of your life has been a little light lately because of probably because of Mass Effect, mostly.
Lately, yes.
I have had a chance to get a couple things off the shelf. I played Massmore with the kids, the two olders, and they absolutely adored it. We're going to be sharing our thoughts on that in a little bit. I played my first round of Martians, A Story of Civilization, the one-player mode. It's a game that was on Kickstarter. It's gotten a lot of real positive buzz, and I can see why. I really enjoy it. I want to play it a couple more times.
Is it thematically tied to like the Kim Stanley Robinson trilogy? Or
not to my knowledge.
Okay.
But I really like what I see there. I think that it's going to be taking it some interesting ways, and I'm curious to see how it juxtapositions next to terraforming Mars as I explore it with other players as well. Got a couple more plays of the Dresden Files in. And then finally, I've been digging into the rules for Arcadia Quest Inferno, and it looks like it continues the fun of Arcadia Quest in all the right ways. It takes the basic Arcadia Quest game and then adds this new mechanic of damnation, which are basically gameplay modifiers that occur based on environmental and situational impacts as you play the game. I don't want to go into too much detail because that is scenario based and campaign based, and that's half the fun, and I know that we're going to be playing it very soon. Suffice to say, based on my read through of the rules, Arcadia Quest Inferno is pretty awesome, and I'm really looking forward to it. Alright, that's what we've had off the shelf this week. As always, join our discussion on the Freebooters forums, on our Facebook page, and any number of other digital outlets that we have. Twitter, Pinterest. And can you talk on Pinterest?
I think so.
All right. So let us know what you've had off the shelf. We're very curious to know. And when we get back, we'll be heading into the Wisdom of Crowds so we can learn about all the newest tabletop gaming news and Kickstarters.
Spoiler alert, not a lot of Kickstarters this week because there's so much news from Gamma. So much news.
We'll see you in just a minute.
So much news. Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview. And now a quick message from our sponsors, Geek Nation Tours. And what an amazing tour they've got coming up at Gen Con 2017, which is, of course, the 50th anniversary of Gen Con. Now, along with hanging out at Gen Con, which is epic in and of itself, this tour is going to have a zombie theme. You're going to get a chance to meet Mantic Games, creators of the Walking Dead all-out war game. You're going to get an opportunity to play with Hunter Games' Outbreak Undead, which is an epic game where you're actually going to have an opportunity to try and survive a real-life zombie apocalypse as you try to return to the hotel from the convention center. Along with all this, you'll also get an opportunity to play the game Zombies, the game Zombie Dice, and you'll get a chance to try out the new Steamforged Games Dark Souls board game based on the amazing video game. So to learn all about that and so much more, head on over to geeknationtours.com and take a look at what's available. And once again, it's time for our Wisdom of Crowds section, our bi-weekly tabletop news and crowdfunding segment. This week, what we're going to do is we're going to spend a little extra time on news because thanks to the Gamma Trade Show, news...
With a side of GaryCon.
Yes, news has absolutely exploded. We have lots and lots to discuss. But in terms of the Kickstarter world, Robert, why don't you go with one of your shout-outs first?
Okay. Just go check out The Prince's Gambit by Onyx Path Publishing. It's their first card game. It's set in the Vampire the Masquerade universe. Go check it out. The Prince's Gambit, based off of Vampire the Masquerade. Jonathan, kick it over to you.
My first shout-out is going to go to the game Aeon's End. And it's a deck-building adventure game. It's pretty cool. I really enjoy it. And they have their very, very first expansion now online as well. And it's doing very well. It's already funded, just shy of $250,000. And it's called Aeon's End War Eternal.
All right, back over to me. Dungeon Crawl Classics, the game where you make four first-level peasants, or zeroth-level peasants, and then you run them through the character funnel, which, i.e., is the adventure where three of your characters will die, and you'll be left with whatever's left. And that'll be your new character. They're coming out with a Lankmar box set based off the Fritz Lieber stories. So Goodman Games for their DCC line makes really good stuff. So it's worth checking out. Back over to you, Jonathan.
My second shout out is for Arcanus, the World of Shattered Empires. It's a 5th edition expansion. It's got a bunch of new races, like 29 new races and subclasses and all kinds of stuff.
An absurd amount of new stuff. And it looks vaguely based on Roman lore.
That's kind of what caught my attention. I thought it was really neat. So that's my second shout out. And how about your final one?
Noir World, which is it's exactly what it sounds. It's the black and white detective where people smoke cigarettes under
I noticed that too. That looks so good.
Yeah, street lamps and stuff. Yeah, it's powered by the Apocalypse World engine. It looks really fun. Just go check it out. We're gonna have links to all these, by the way, in our show notes, so if any of these sound interesting, you want to know more, just go click on it. And then Jonathan, just tell us, how's Rising Sun doing?
Oh, and that is definitely my last shout out. So as of today, 1 week until Rising Sun funds, and it's currently sitting at $3.16 million.
Which is to say, by the time you hear this, funding will be over. Well,
yeah.
There you go.
Well,
go check it out. There'll be a lot of pretty pictures of pretty miniatures, and by the time you hear this, it'll probably be over. So
yeah, they've got so many more monsters opened up. There you go. That is our Kickstarter shout-out, since we're not doing a traditional Kickstarter session. So let's move into the news, Robert. And first up...
Put on your seatbelts, people. This is going to go for a little bit.
Shadow War Armageddon. So let's just dive right into the Games Workshop news.
So it's one of their box games, like Necromunda, like Mordheim, like Blood Bowl. I don't know how much they're going to expand it or not, but they say it's going to be a squad-based game instead of, you know, 40K's army-based games.
And it does take place in the 40K universe,
yes,
right?
This does take place in the 40K universe, and it will be Orcs versus the Blood Angels.
Who are Space Marines.
Those are Space Marines, yes. They're one of the factions of Space Marines. And... with a name like Blood Angels, you know, they paint themselves red.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at some of the art right here, and it's traditional Games Workshop awesome.
If you're a fan of the Blood Angels or just want a smaller scale game, this looks actually pretty promising. So
yeah, no, it does. It does.
Check it out. It looks fun. And, you know, smaller scale stuff is always a good time because
it's kind of like the Imperial Assault variant. And my understanding is that when you buy their board games, you can actually use those minis in the larger games, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. When you talk about like value for your dollar, I think that that's a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, there. Yeah. Sometimes people get games like that just to, you know, like, oh, there's a cool Blood Angels model in there. I will use it in my Blood Angels army. Ta-da. So when we hear more, I'm sure we will mention it. But,
yep.
But that is Shadow War Armageddon.
Moving right along, Robert, I'm going to go ahead and take this next one. So we got a new Age of Sigmar faction, and this might be the one to finally push me to get an Age of Sigmar army, and that is the Caradhron Overlords, who look awesome.
It's not just Reese's Pieces, man. It's not just chocolate and peanut butter. It's like chocolate, peanut butter, bacon wrapped in Cthulhu, because not only do you got dwarves, not only do you have steampunk, but they're also sky pirates.
Yes, I know. That's where it gets me.
Yeah.
I mean, like, half the models that they show off in this thing are awesome because they're all on little standees and they're just zipping around in jetpacks. And then the ships, every single one of the ships is off the ground, just floating around. They're like little steampunky armored dirigibles with cannons. I mean, like, this is everything I want.
The ships are what really got me. Like, the guys, the normal soldiers are, you know, it's dwarves with balloons over their heads.
Yeah.
All three of those boats that they have pictured are gorgeous.
All these dwarves are just covered in armor from head to toe. I mean, some of them even have beard armor, which, I mean, I got to say, I kind of respect.
Well, you got to respect the beard.
I mean,
man.
Like, if I was in combat, I'd put armor on my beard, too.
The beard is a status symbol. I remember in their MMO, your beard actually got bigger the more you leveled up. Because, you know, it's a point of pride for the dwarves. You know, you got to protect your beard. If you get it cut off, you'll lose some of your mojo.
Folks, if you get a chance, go to bellofsouls.net. There will be a link in the show notes. The pictures of these models are phenomenal. I mean, this just looks like such a neat, fun faction. And it's so unlike anything else in Age of Sigmar.
Well, Age of Sigmar has been it's been very, very high fantasy. You know, they've been pushing weird ground. It's fun because the human faction is the one that's been mainly doing that. So it's interesting to see the dwarf faction that finally showed up be like weird kind of hyper fantasy steampunky dwarves.
I love this first bit of art that they released where the dwarves are some are in the jetpacks and the balloons, others are in their little airships, and it's fighting against this gigantic winged demon with an axe and a whip. I mean, it's just such a great piece of art that just sold me on the whole thing.
That is the Caradhron Overlords, coming soon to an Age of Sigmar table near you.
Now we get a chance to see a little bit of a throwdown kind of forming, a little shootout at the OK Corral, so to speak. There's a tumbleweed cruising across a dusty street as Seamon and Fantasy Flight square off over the Game of Thrones license. So this, of course, is the Song of Ice and Fire miniature game, which Cool Mini or Not just recently announced. It's kind of interesting because, you know, Fantasy Flight's had this book version of the Game of Thrones license kind of locked up for a while, and they produced a lot of games around it, including one of my favorites, the Living Card Game. The Living Card Game for Game of Thrones is just fantastic.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about the board game, too.
Yeah, the board game is phenomenal.
Especially the second edition, because apparently the first edition's art was kind of bad, and the expansion added a lot of stuff that really needed to be in the game. And the second edition, just read it in the art and put in all that stuff.
Yeah, the second edition is sublime. It's a great game.
I looked at the miniatures for these. I mean, it's everything you'd expect from Game of Thrones. They've got, you know, the various houses to throw down. So, yeah, you can be House Targaryen, you can be House Greyjoy, you can do the Starks. Yeah, you can redo your favorite. Dude, the Battle of the Bastards. That'd be fun. Anyway, so it's coming to a Kickstarter near you sometime soon. Now, gentle listener, will this be real soon, Blizzard soon, or Steam soon? Only time will tell.
Seamon is pretty good about their Kickstarter dates. They have that stuff kind of ironed out at the beginning of the year. They tend to do one a quarter.
Okay, so this will be probably the next one.
Yeah.
So a quarter, I guess we're moving into quarter three right now.
Yeah,
quarter
two right now. I'd say that I would suspect that the Kickstarter is going to happen May to June, maybe even July. Just right in the dead of summer. It's got to distance itself from Rising Sun.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're asking too much from your customers, even if this is kind of speaking to a slightly different group.
The ad stuff says that battles will range from large-scale wars with hundreds of miniatures to simple skirmishes between a few units without complicating the elegantly designed rules. That's good because, yeah, like, doing both scales is actually real hard. The game features several unique systems, including alternating activations, a rank system that changes the unit's capabilities as the battle ranges on, iconic heroes such as Robb Stark and Jaime Lannister that change the course of war both on and off the battlefield. sounds like they're trying to take the license and do something a little new with it. I will be very interested to see if they can pull off the magic bullet of having a game that plays both well on the small scale and on the large scale.
Yeah, agreed.
We will see how it shakes out. It'll come to Kickstarter. I guarantee you we'll talk about it.
So on the other side of that shootout is FFG. And one thing that FFG picked up last year was Legend of the Five Rings, and they have yet to do anything with it, but it looks like the time has come.
Yes, so they announced at Gamma that they will basically be previewing the new version of the card game at Gen Con. So it's not even coming out this Gen Con, it is just being previewed.
Well, if this is anything like what they did with the Star Wars RPG, we'll get the preview at Gen Con, we'll have a beta going out to parties that do the beta testing for them at the beginning of next year, and then Gen Con the following year is when we'll see the bigger release, and then that'll follow with a retail release in the holiday
quarter. If they keep some of the L5R traditions, they might release before that and do their first big tournament, because one of the things of old L5R was Origins and Gen Con were big story-changing tournaments where they would take the results of whatever clan won something, and that would actually alter the course of Rokugan history. So
I'm curious to see if this uses the same engine that powers the Game of Thrones or the Star Wars LCGs, because those are adversarial in nature, and even though they have some unique mechanics, they're still basically running off of that same core Diana Jones award-winning Eric Lang engine.
We'll definitely hear more of this Gen Con, but yeah, at least we're now starting to hear that something's coming, which is good news.
Yes, absolutely.
Paizo had a bunch of Starfinder news, including the final image of the cover, which was pretty sweet. And they announced that, of all people, Ninja Division are going to do the miniatures for Starfinder.
I'm kind of okay with that.
Yeah, it was kind of out of the blue, because like WizKids just does everything these days. You know, it's like, oh, WizKids is doing the D&D miniatures. WizKids is doing the Pathfinder miniatures. But then it's like, and then here we go, Ninja Division is going to do the Starfinder miniatures. I got to say, the Starfinder miniatures look pretty rad. They're going to do ships, which is cool.
Yeah.
And they're going to do just people. But the fact that they are doing ships makes me think that ship combat is going to be a core part of these rules. And I have seen a lot of vehicle combat based off of 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons, and none of it has really been, I don't know, what's a good word?
Good.
I'll go with good, yeah. It gets a little complicated.
The rule set's too darn crunchy to support it.
Yeah, I remember D20 Future had you roll absurd amounts of D6s to do laser damage. And I'm talking like in the hundreds. So
I do have to say, it's almost like I'm looking at the pictures of those Ninja Division ships, and it's almost like the Battlefleet Gothic style went organic.
Because there's obviously technological ships, but there's a race or two that does organic stuff.
Yeah,
so
but it all has this very Gothic styling with the high spires and the stretched out lines. It's interesting. You know, Ninja Division makes a nice mini. They really
we talked about Relic Knights. Of those miniatures are awesome.
And so look at some of these characters, man. These races look interesting. They look cool.
Starfinder, for sure, takes place in the far future of the Pathfinder universe. So the same setting that you play Pathfinder in is the same setting that Starfinder takes place. The world has been vanished. I don't think it got blown up. I think it just got gone. And so now there's a big, giant Death Star-sized space station where that planet used to be. And most of the action, from what I've been reading, takes place within that star system. So they actually did a adventure path where you went planet hopping. And it's those same planets, but again, in the far future.
I am kind of somewhat excited. Even though I'm not the biggest Pathfinder fan from a rule set perspective, I dig a good sci-fi RPG. I like that it's sticking to the same universe. That's kind of neat. And I'm also hoping that it expands into the adventure card game, because I'd be totally down with a Starfinder adventure card game.
That would be fun if they did a release of Starfinder based off of the, because they're doing an adventure path for Starfinder as well, so they could just do it based off that. That would be rad.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking ahead.
I mean, even if it's the same mechanics, but just, you know, you get the random sci-fi one just for fun.
Yeah. Paizo, feel free to give me a call. I've got some ideas for you. Now, moving on, next up on the list is Crossfire.
Crossfire!
Not that one.
Oh, okay.
And this is coming to us from Plaid Hat Games.
Wait. Is this the game where you shoot BBs at each other on the board? No.
Like I said, not that one.
At like half our audience, I'm sure, doesn't even know what the hell I'm talking about. That's like, that just dated me pretty bad.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think anybody in our audience over 30 got it. Anybody under 30, not so much.
Yeah, I'm sure the commercial's on YouTube. Go YouTube Crossfire.
Crossfire! Yeah, so Crossfire. It's coming to us from Plaid Hat, and Plaid Hat has a really nice production value. Like, their games tend to be really, really nice.
Their Mycenistics game was real pretty. Tell us about Crossfire, Jonathan. because all I've got in my head is shooting BBs across a board. I need to purge that from my brain.
So Crossfire actually takes place in the same universe as Spectre Ops, and basically takes you deeper into this universe. And in this universe, it's kind of Blade Runner meets Shadowrun.
Okay.
Because you have like wolfmen and stuff running around, and ladies that are half bionic arachnid. It's an interesting universe, and Spectre Ops really didn't do much with the universe itself. It used it as a backdrop for a really good hidden movement game.
Hmm.
This, on the other hand, is mission-based, and you're using deception and you're using negotiation. There's not really a ton that has been talked about in terms of actual gameplay mechanics, but you have two teams that are either trying to protect or assassinate the VIP from Raxxon, which is one of the corporations in the universe.
Yeah.
It's definitely got hidden traitor mechanic, because you are trying to figure out who at the table, you know, is actually who they claim to be, etc. So there's definitely a traitor mechanic there. And that makes sense, because there was a traitor mechanic in Spectre Ops as well, which was kind of fun when you play with...
So the setup is you're a team trying to go do some sort of mission, and somebody's a spy?
Yes, exactly.
Somebody's working against the team secretly?
They haven't shown very much in terms of gameplay. They haven't shown very much in terms of components yet.
Yeah, they just kind of said it's coming.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting, because it's supposed to be out in the summer, so I would have expected a lot more media around it, but
you know what,
no.
they're saving it for Gen Con
probably,
so we'll be
probably
talking about this again in 4 months.
So the Spectre Ops universe is expanding with Crossfire, and so we'll have to see what Plaid Hat does with that.
Well, next up on our list, relative newcomer to the gaming scene, Renegade Studios announced a new game called Flip Ship.
All right, so let's talk about Flip Ships. It's a cooperative dexterity game, and basically players are taking on the role of pilots that are trying to defend their planet from an onslaught of firepower. So think Galaga.
Yeah.
It's Galaga the dexterity game. You flip your ships to take out encroaching enemies, and you're trying to take down the big mothership before it's too late and your planet's fully invaded.
Again, so I know dexterity games kind of get a bad look.
You know, which really isn't fair. I mean, that's just... It really, really isn't fair, because I think dexterity games have their place in the world. They're fun.
Here's why I want to bring it up. Renegade Games, I like all of their board games. I mean, some of them are a little hit and miss, but everything that they've done has been pretty good.
Yeah, they did a great one called Fuse that is super, super fun, especially with a large group.
Yeah, Gravwell was the same way. Like, Gravwell, I played it with two people, and I thought it was the dumbest game ever, and then I had five people, or was it four? I think it caps at four. Anyway, I had the maximum number of people that you can play. And it got really good. It was very tactical.
Now, Gravwell is a cool game.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to this just because I like Renegade Studios. So hopefully...
Much like Crossfire, there's not a ton available on this. There's not a lot of media. There's not a lot of screenshots, but...
they were basically telling retailers it's coming.
Yeah. And you know, like you said, Renegade's got a good record. I think it's safe to say that this will probably be a really fun game.
Speaking of things that are coming soon, WizKids was showing off their next D&D trophy at Gamma, and they had a really, really cheesy mock-up of it, which was basically, I think it was just made out of foam. And I mean like packing foam. Like, it was a very, very rough mock-up. But so far, we've had the Red Dragon, then we had the Mind Flayer, and next up,
the Beholder.
Oh my god. And they showed a picture of it. It's huge!
Yeah, it really
is huge. It's so big! I'm so excited. It just, like, it's the dumbest thing ever, but I want to have a Beholder on my wall so bad. Like the dragon, I was like, yeah, the dragon. Oh, but Beholders. Well, there's something about Beholders.
They're iconic.
Yeah.
They're iconic.
It's one of the few monsters that Pathfinder technically doesn't have, although they might have something like Observers, or they might have skirted that issue somehow. I'm not sure. But yeah, that's one of the ones that Wizards held on to with third edition.
The Beholders influenced a lot of fantastic, iconic fantasy items over the years.
It's influenced everything. They had Beholders in Doom.
Yeah, there's a Beholder style monster in Doom. There's a Beholder style monster in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yep.
I mean, you know, everywhere you look, there's these critters that all come back just to this iconic
floating
D&D character,
floating orbs of flesh with eyes.
Yeah, pretty much. Sounds like an awesome, you know, metal band.
Floating orbs of flesh with eyes. Thank you, Texas.
I can't wait to see a finished one.
I know. And it's probably going to be super expensive, because it is significantly larger than the other two and much more complicated with all the ice stocks. So that thing is going to be like $600, I'm sure.
Man, Cool Mini or not, back in the news. And this is actually kind of interesting, because this is the first time Cool Mini or not is outright starting to woo the FLGS. So CMON has announced organized play kits. walk us through some of the things that they've got there. I'd be curious to see your thoughts, being a former store owner, on how their approach is.
Okay, so they're doing two things. They're doing pre-release kits, which gives FLGSs the opportunity to get new games 2 weeks ahead of its release date, which that's huge. Like, it's very surprising how powerful that is for FLGSs.
I see they're firing the Eric Lang cannon in the first salvo of this thing.
Yes.
Because so, The Godfather is one of the first pre-release kits coming up.
Yeah. That game looks amazing. The other thing they're doing is they're introducing game night kits. And this is awesome because organized play in stores is really big. And having exclusive items that you can give players who come and show up to play games at your place, giving them some sort of prize is really awesome. So the first two are
right up my alley.
Right up your alley. It's Zombicide Black Plague, where it's kind of funny. So the ad copy reads that you're going to get this guy called Valkmar, but the card that they show in the art, they call him Bruce.
Yeah, that about makes sense.
But it's supposed to be kind of a riff off of Mad Mardigan from Willow.
Yeah.
And I noticed his card said, there's like, I guess there's a secondary like item slot, and it said he can have a sword, so he can like dual wield, I guess.
Yeah.
Which looks awesome.
And I got to tell you that having looked over his character card earlier today, we were chatting about it, and now that I've had a chance to study it, he's an awesome character. I kind of need him.
So the kit comes with 14 of those. It comes with 14 zombie counter base sets in six necromancer colors. I have no idea what that means. 26 dice and 2 scenario books, which means the play kit will have its own unique scenario that you
which
can play your
awesome.
Shop. Which is really cool.
Which is awesome.
So, and then the other one that they're launching is Blood Rage, which Jonathan only kind of talks about that every frickin' podcast.
Yeah, because it's a good game.
It supports 8 players. It's going to release. The Zombicide one is going to release in June 2017. Next up is Blood Rage. This is going to come out in August, so just a couple months later. Supports 8 players. It's going to have 4 first player tokens, 2 sets of cardboard dashboard sets.
Hold on.
Okay.
It's important to define what these tokens are. Okay. These tokens are not like little acrylic things. These are fully sculpted, fully molded tokens that are in the shape of the different clans for Blood Rage. I mean, like, this is... I've got to tell you, as a heavy Blood Rage player, I'm salivating over these. They are the perfect way to pimp out your Blood Rage. And one of the chief problems I had with the Blood Rage production is that the little tableaus that you get for your clans and whatnot are very, very thin, as is the tracker for the different ages. And so they're releasing cardboard variants of it, which are nice and thick cardstock. Yeah, I'm all over this too.
Yep. And then the last thing you get in it is 2 sets of 20 tokens. I'm not sure what the tokens are. Did you see them in the art?
They're just different tokens from the game. And again, they're just nice upgraded versions rather than the cardboard ones.
So, yeah, it's a really good reason to go into your FLGS and, you know, throw down some bucks to basically, I don't know if playing a tournament's the right word, but to play in an organized play event where, you know, you could potentially walk away with some of these things as prizes. And it's, since I would assume that, you know, you might only hand out one of each of these things or split it up. I mean, it's up to your FLGS how they split it up, or maybe they'll have suggestions in there. But it's also a good way to, like, encourage people to play multiples.
Yeah.
Because if you want to get all 4 sets, then maybe, you know, you should show up to 4 events or try to talk your FLGS into hosting 4 events so you get the opportunity to try it.
Allow me to be the first to say, if you're in the Austin area and you own an FLGS and you want somebody to sell copies of both Black Plague and Blood Rage, I would be more than happy to do all the selling. Just get me one of these Mad Mardigans and get me like a full set of tokens and I'm yours. And you'll never have seen that many units move. I'm going to push them.
This is going to be followed up a little bit later in the year with Potion Explosion and the Bloodboard card game, which are already out, but they're going to, I'm assuming, have promo cards or something. We'll see what happens later. That is in the future.
Potion Explosion's on my shortlist because that is Kevin Wilson and Eric Lang together.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Well, there you go. So Simon's doing some good stuff to get into the FLGSs, which I encourage.
This very much feels like an I'm sorry I've been kickstarting all these years letter. You know, I do have to say, I really
well.
Like
they've really been expanding their board game line that they do straight to FLGSs. So maybe this is more of an overture of that. Where
yes,
you know, maybe they've gotten some blowback where people are like, "I'm not going to carry you. You just kickstart." It's like, yes, but we have this like crazy, actually fairly huge line of games that we just released now.
Yeah, I think they're transitioning into a full, you know, not just Kickstarter. I think they're transitioning into a full publisher.
So yeah, good on them. These kits look really nice. The MSRP on them, which is looking into it. Like it's what the retailer pays is actually kind of high. So if they charge you a couple bucks to join in on this, do not be shocked. But, you know, maybe they will, maybe they won't. I don't know how it works.
I can understand why it's expensive, though. Like, these, there's a lot of plastic in this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're
that's
getting
the thing.
Models.
Yeah, this is not cheap.
This is not cards. I mean, well, maybe it is for Bloodborne and Potion Explosion. But, you know, for Blood Rage and Zombicide, you're getting models. Functional models that had to be tested.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, too. You don't see a lot of game night and things with board games, which I think would be really cool. Because I mean, every game store's got demos. This is
more than a demo. This is just asking for them
to open up one of your games and use it as a demo, because they're going to have to do it to run this event anyway, and then they're going to keep the game and it'll be on your shelf and blah blah blah. Like it's just good sense.
So now let's turn our attention back to D&D. Goodman Games is reprinting classic modules.
Yes, so Goodman Games is a very old company. They kind of got in the game right at the tail end of third edition, and they were one of the few companies that supported fourth. And they make Dungeon Crawl Classics, which we mentioned earlier.
There's always the one, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. it was a smart move, because Wizards has now given them the Classic Adventures B1, In Search of the Unknown, and B2, the classic, The Keep on the Borderlands, one of the most played D&D adventures of all time. One of the 5th edition playtests was just an updated version of this.
Yeah.
Which was, I believe they called it the Caverns of Chaos, but that's Keep on the Borderlands. It's the Caverns of Chaos is just where all the monsters are in that adventure. So what they're going to do is they're going to release a hardback book. It's going to have the original adventures in it.
Is it going to have the TSR logo on it, like the picture that they released?
Oh, I hope so.
I know, me too, right?
The old school stupid logo. That really awful one with the wizard is the wizard. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and then on the other promo image for the B1 module, the In Search of the Unknown, it actually has the old TSR logo with TSR on it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And they're also going to include conversion notes so you can play it with 5th edition as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's bang for your buck. And here's the thing: these old modules, they're not good by modern standards because there's no plot. I mean, Keep on the Borderlands basically. Is there's two maps. There's the Keep on the Borderlands, which is just some dude's castle, which is a map and a number key and a very short description of NPCs that live there, including dude who owns shop who will sell stuff, and then it's a number key for the Caverns of Chaos. And that was kind of cool because there is a lot of like, if this monster dies here, if he gets away, he's going to run over here and do this. And so there's a lot of moving parts in that adventure, which is kind of fun, but still not a lot of plot. It's like, hey, adventurers, go, there's monsters over there and they probably have loots. Go kill them. And you're like, yeah, murder hobos away. So I've actually never read In Search of the Unknown. So I'm actually
so much history here.
Oh,
this
I know.
Is so good. I'm so glad they're
it's
doing
just
this.
Remember classic adventures. You kind of had to insert your own plot. That was sort of their idea for them, was this would be part of your campaign. And so you were supposed to do the hard work of figuring out how it worked in.
I will be curious to see how these translate over to 5th edition, I have to say.
Well, you know what? I know on the DMs Guild, some people have already done this. they already have these update packets for it, but a pretty hardback book. I'm a sucker for that. I know I'm probably going to end up getting that. I can just tell. I
think that goes without saying.
Yeah.
Dude, this is your Blood Rage. This is your Rising Sun. I totally dig it and I understand it.
Yeah, I can just tell. I'm probably going to get it. Because there's a long dry spell of 5th edition official TSR or wizard stuff. And it happens right after November. Because there's nothing out until March. And that'll be when they get me. Because that's when I'll fail my wisdom save right then. Because I'll want a new book for Christmas. And there won't be one.
All right. So now, finally,
last but not least, our Lucky Charm.
our homies over at Privateer Press.
Our Lucky Charm. They've been hinting what's coming up next for the community integrated development, which is actually two things. I read the second one. First up, Steamroller 2017, their tournament packet, is going to get released on the community integrated development, which will be interesting because rumor has it that they're going to go a really, really weird way with a lot of their new scenarios. So, like, it's going to be stupidly easy to score points, and you're going to have to score a lot of points, not the traditional 5 like the last several years of packets. So that'll be fun to see, like, just how much they're changing it. And since they're changing it a lot, it's probably good they're allowing us to playtest it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kudos to changing everything around, and kudos for letting us try it out and ironing out any weird points.
Yeah, I think Privateer Press is really on a good track right now. There was a slight bit of rockiness when third edition launched, but I think that they've managed to put that behind them, and I think that the decisions that they're making around third edition are really, really strong and positive right now, so I've got a lot of faith.
Yeah, they're definitely getting the ship in the right direction.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
And then the other thing they mentioned recently is they're going to put the battle engines back into community integrated development, and they are going to buff the ever living crud out of them because
you and I were talking about that a little bit earlier. That's a needed change.
Yeah, because right now, I mean, the battle engines don't typically have much more health than a war beast does, and a war beast has a lot more rules that help it out. You know, they've been talking about giving it like double damage and adding a whole bunch of crazy rules to them, and just they're big, they're centerpiece models, they draw your eye, they want people to play them
because they're gorgeous.
Yeah,
I mean, they're just stunning models, and they should be powerful for what they bring to the table.
Right, so it's supposed to be this gigantic machine of war that people are bringing instead of war beasts, so they should be good.
They were too gummy,
so
squishy, just too squishy.
I like that idea, and even if it makes them cost stupid amounts of points, you know, just making them really cool big models that you can play with that are fun. So that is the wisdom of crowds.
And after a short break, we'll be back with our deep dive. And today we're going to be looking at Cool Mini or Not's Mass Mora,
the Dungeons of Arcadia.
So we'll be right back after a short break from our sponsors.
Captain, come in. It's a war zone out here. The trolls are about to overrun our position. There's casualties everywhere. No one can have a decent conversation without exploding into flame wars! I understand, sir. The other Mont and I are trying to hold them back, but no matter how many we ban, they just keep coming back in greater numbers! Captain, tell my wife. Free Buddhist Forums. A great place to chat with no trolls and no BS. All gaming, all the time. www.freebuddhas.com.
We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by doing one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmydice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment, or you can message us directly via the Facebook Messenger.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our posts at forgotmydice.com.
You can also message us or tweet us on the Twitter. Find us at ForgotMyDice.
You can join us on the Freebooter Network message boards. Find your way there by going to freebootersnetwork.com and click on the Freebooters Forum.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give the Freebooters Network a review on iTunes.
Lastly, for those of you listening from the depths of interstellar space, make sure you turn your controls 18 degrees to the left and flip the intensifier disc on and off again.
Interstellar space?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on interocitors.
And welcome back, and now it's time for our deep dive. In this episode, we are going to be going into the Dungeons of Arcadia with Mass Mora.
Mass Mora was a magical dungeon built beneath the streets of Arcadia. It was meant to be a training grounds for young heroes until it was taken over by the evil wizard Malefius. Now the heroes play through several rounds, delving deeper into the dungeon, facing off against nasty monsters and gaining experience as they go. Included are three different variants on the way you play. You can play competitively, which is what we did, for overall fame and glory, or in an epic campaign, or you can join forces and cooperate to take down one of the greatest villains Arcadia has ever faced.
All right, so let's talk about Mass Mora. Like you said in the introduction, there are, in fact, three different ways that you can play. Two of them are kind of like, think of it as bonus rule sets. There's a cooperative version that's bonus, and then there's an epic version that basically takes the traditional rules and makes the game a little bit larger in terms of both the tiles that you visit and can visit and how much experience you can gain and how you level up. We're going to primarily focus on the core rule set because that really is the focus of the game. And that's very clear in the rule book as there's two pages devoted to those other two game modes. And the rest of the very, very large instruction book is dedicated to Mass Mora. So it's a 1-5 player game. It plays in 20 to 45 minutes. Its suggested age is 13 and above, but I have successfully played it with both my 7-year-old and my 9-year-old, and there were no changes to the rules.
So the basic gist of the game is it's kind of like, oddly for me, it reminded me of Betrayal of the House on the Hill, because you start on a square, which is the beginning of a dungeon, and then you just start moving around and exploring the dungeon. And instead of having a number of actions, what you do instead is you roll dice. You also have a free movement, so you can move without rolling dice. Otherwise, if you...
Which I like that they call it a free step, by the way, because it just kind of ties it back to role-playing games, and that's fun.
So you roll 6 dice, And the sides are a little arrow, a little bow and arrow, actually, for ranged attacks. There's a sword, which is for melee attacks. There is a little shield, and that is defense. There is a little sparkle, which is your magic. And the sparkle actually allows you to change another die into anything you want.
Or depending on what kind of character you are,
yeah, you might have magic
use
attacks.
Magic as a ranged attack.
Right. There's little potion bottles with a little plus for health. And then there's little footprints, and that's the movement. And those are your six sides. And so what you do is you roll. You can keep however many of those dice that you have, and then you roll again, and then you got to use those dice to determine what you do. And on top of that, most characters have abilities based off of their class. And it might be something as simple as most characters have a base ability where if you spend a defense and a sword together, it actually turns into a defense and two swords. I saw that very commonly throughout a lot of the characters. Not everybody has it, but that's a pretty common one. And then as you level up, you unlock more abilities. Like, I was playing a paladin, because gotta play the paladin, people. Gotta play that paladin. And one of my abilities was I could spend a potion to heal, and not only would I spend that potion to heal, but I'd also gain 2 gold instead of the normal just spending one to heal. I mean, that's the gist of it. You roll dice, you use sets to, you know, do your actions, combat, exploring, whatever. And then you explore the dungeon and you try to get to 16 XP first. And that is the gist of it.
Yeah.
That except for the treasure cards.
Exactly.
Talk to me about treasure cards, Jonathan.
Well, as you go through the dungeon, as you both explore treasure spots and kill enemies, you do gain these treasure cards. And these treasure cards have two sides to them. They have the upper side and the lower side. The lower side is an effect that can generally be played on your turn. And this,
and they're typically not quite as awesome, but they're more useful.
This could be 2 shields or heal 2 or any number of different things.
And these are played outside of your normal dice allotment.
And then the top of the cards actually is what I like to call the mess with your opponent layer on the card. That is the core of Arcadia Quest. It's all about stabbing the other guy in the back. That is what makes the game fun. In these cards, they tend to be like stealing an XP point when another player was about to make it, or all the monsters this round have 1 extra defense point, or hey, all of the monsters this round do 1 extra point of damage. What I love about the treasure cards is that you really have to be careful about how you use them, because you have to balance them out between the bottom row item and the top row item. And oftentimes you're looking at both sides of that card and you're just thinking to yourself, wow, I kind of want both of these. And that's really fun.
And on top of that, your hand limit is 6. So yes, if you're getting close to your hand limit, you might as well start spending them.
Exactly. And it's not like these cards are hard to come by, because you can get them 3 different ways. You can get them by killing monsters. You can get them by exploring treasure chests. And you can also just outright buy them. Every time you get to 5 coins, you can just outright buy a treasure card.
And that's not an action either. You can just do it.
You can tell that developers really want you to run through those cards, because there are...
Oh, did we? Yeah. I mean, our game wasn't overly long. I think we only explored like maybe a dozen rooms. And I went through 7 or 8 cards.
And you know, honestly, that is the way they want you to play the game, because those cards are an integral part of how you interact with the game. And that's a big part of how I won, because I was able to stretch out my economy of actions much farther than you. And I was able to kind of squeeze in a couple of extra XP points just from having those extra actions on hand.
All right. So let's walk through the basic turn order.
You start off on a square and you have your free step that you can use right away before rolling dice, or you can roll your dice first, whichever you prefer. Once you roll your dice, you basically have an economy for that turn's actions. Of course, like you mentioned earlier, you can do a reroll of anything you don't like. And then you
just once, unless you get a card that says differently.
Just once. And then you start using those dice to perform those actions by locking them into place on either the tableau in front of you or onto the special abilities that you unlock as the game progresses. So you have one slot open, you lock your die into that particular slot, you get the rewards, which count just like dice, right? They're the exact same symbols, and then you move on with the expenditure of the rest of your dice. So it's great, because it kind of becomes a gamble, and the best part about it is, between the free step that you always have, which is represented by a token in front of you, and the treasure cards, even if you get an unlucky roll, generally speaking, there's always going to be a way for you to mitigate that unluckiness and pull something out of your turn, which I think is a really good sign of how well balanced this game is.
I would agree. Like, there was a time in the game where you were trying to drown me in monsters. I unlocked an ability by progressing through my turn that allowed me to spend gold to make extra attacks.
Yep.
And I managed to clear a room that you thought was going to murder me. So it's really good in that regard. Also, when you discover rooms, some of them spawn monsters in them, or spawn multitudes of monsters in them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just monster spawning rooms that just keep spawning monsters. And the way that you spawn monsters is they come in two flavors in the base set. There's the blue monsters, which are your, shall we say,
they're called minor monsters.
Minor monsters, or monsters that probably don't have cool names. Monsters that wouldn't have backstories if there was a movie. It would just be the tons of orcs and cultists and just guys that you're there to slaughter. And then there's the orange dice, which are the major players. Those are big, scary monsters. But what's cool about that is they are randomly generated. So when a monster spawns, you just roll the dice. And there's six.
Each side of the die has a different monster on
it. Yeah, and it's one of six different monsters on it, which is really fun. And some rooms say very specifically, this monster's in it, so go find a die and just put this face up.
Yeah.
And then some rooms, you know, just says roll extra monsters or whatnot. And then occasionally you'll find rooms that have boss monsters in them, which are represented by these little, you have the coin pack, which is snazzy. But
yes.
Normally they would be a piece of cardboard that has two sides. And the reason they're boss monsters is you gotta just kill them twice.
So let's talk about the monster stats for a moment. When you come across a monster on the monster die and on the boss chits, what you have is you have a number and a shield, which represents their armor. You have to meet or exceed that number in a single expenditure of damage through any combination of both melee and ranged attacks to kill that monster and get its XP.
The XP are represented by little orange dots at the top of the dice face. And then it also should be said, at higher levels, one of the things that happens is it says you get minus one XP from killing monsters because you're much more powerful at that point because you have two class abilities.
Which I think, again, it does a really good job of kind of grabbing onto some RPG tropes and wielding them.
Well, in my case, you got up to that pretty fast, and that was very, very bad for Robert Morrell. I tilted a little bit when that happened. But I caught up like almost instantly because like you got like three XP for killing three different monsters, and then I cleared that room and I caught up.
Yeah.
So the second stat on the monster die is how much damage the monster does attacking you back in melee. So if you expend melee damage points, you're going to get hit back unless you use shields to defend that damage.
Exactly. It's called payback.
And you have 6 HP, and if you lose it all, you lose a turn, basically, and then you come back, and you're at the beginning of the XP for your level, basically. So
exactly.
Most levels have, like, 5 or 6 XP, so if you're about to level up and you die, you're just back at the beginning, and you have to kill that many more monsters. So dying's not a huge deal. It's more like somebody knocks you out.
There is a small penalty. You want to avoid it, because you also lose a random treasure card as well, which is tough. When you died in our last game, you didn't have any treasure cards, so I didn't have to take any from you. But yeah, there is a small penalty for dying, but ultimately you stand right back up, you've got plenty of health left, and then you can fight your way on out. And the good thing about fighting, of course, is that you're gaining XP and gaining treasure cards, which makes you a more powerful opponent. Now, anytime you expend one of your move options, whether that's using your free step or using a die with feet on it, you get 2 move points. And that means that you can move either 2 squares, or you can move a square and do what's called the explore action, or you can just outright do the explore action, which ends all of your movement points for that particular expenditure.
And then you take a random tile and you place it in the dungeon, and then you do whatever's on it.
Now, what's interesting about this is you stack the tiles before you start playing the game, and the top one is flipped over and revealed, so you know what's coming. You know what your next room is. Why do you want to explore? Well, because oftentimes you will have options to get XP, which is what you're going after for a win condition, especially if you get lucky and you can explore one of the larger rooms, because you get a couple of XP for even just exploring those larger rooms.
Mm-hmm.
When you do place your new tile, you start flipping the next tile on the stack. And the reason why that can be a little bit hairy is because in the stack of tiles are both modifier tiles, which have some form of curse or bad thing that happens to you, or there are also trap tiles. And if a trap tile comes out, it gets placed right next to the tile that you just explored, and it automatically does 1 bit of damage to you, and it will continue to do damage to you unless you disarm that trap.
And that is a card effect on a treasure card.
Yeah, and disarming the trap is basically locking 2 of your die with specific symbols into that trap, which then disables the trap. You flip the tile over, and it's out of the game, and then you gain your XP and move on without an any additional damage. We talked a little bit about combat, getting a little deeper into combat. If you used ranged attacks, then monsters will not get a chance to do their payback to you, which means that you're not going to take any damage. But anytime that you use any kind of melee attack, even if you're doing it in a combination with ranged attacks, at the end of combat, even if you kill that monster, they're going to do payback damage to you. And that damage goes anywhere from only 1 point all the way up to like 4 or 5. And considering your health of 6, that can sometimes be a bad thing.
But again, if you spend any defense dice, you can just sort of soak that damage. And all of the paladins that I looked at had the base ability of spin a defense and a sword, and it actually counts as 2 swords and a defense. So it's pretty easy to mitigate some of the damage. So Jonathan, the age-old Forgot My Dice question. Since you taught me this game and I didn't even look at it, how's that rule book?
Well, unfortunately, in Cool Mini or Not fashion, it's a little bit all over the place. Is everything that you need to know to play the game effectively in this book? Yes, without a doubt. Is it laid out in a way that makes sense and is easy to reference? Not even remotely. With the others, with Zombicide, with Arcadia Quest, this is continuing to be a problem with Cool Mini or Not. This is kind of, unfortunately, what I've come to expect when I get one of their games. Unfortunately, they just don't lay out information in a way that makes sense. I don't know whether that's just to me or if it's to the broader audience. I'd actually be curious to see what other people thought about that. So if you have an opinion on the matter, please weigh in. But the rulebook starts out in a good way. The basic setup is really fast. It spells it out very, very nicely. Now, where things start to get a little weird is when it starts to explain the game to you, because it goes through all of your basic actions on the die, which makes a lot of sense, and it has some really good gameplay examples. But then it leaves certain parts out in terms of what disarming a trap is, spawning new rooms altogether, spawning monsters, limits to monsters in rooms, etc. And all that stuff gets left out until you get to the second portion of the instruction guide, which is the Dungeon Master Guide. And then all of a sudden, all these things that you probably should have known a little bit earlier get filled in. And again, all the information's there, it's just not laid out very well.
Yeah, and it's funny, because they call that phase where the monsters attack you and all that, they call that the Dungeon Master phase. But the Dungeon Master is the players themselves, it's not like there's somebody else running the game, so I don't get why they just didn't mash all that together. Like, why does it need 2 sections on player stuff and Dungeon Master stuff?
And we haven't really talked about the Dungeon Master phase yet, so let's cover that real quick. Basically, you get 2 phases, and the first phase is you're burning all your actions, which we already talked. Second phase is you get 2 movement points, and you can use those to move any monster on the board 1 box, 1 square. And you can do the same monster twice, but you're capped at 2 points, unless you have a card modifier, which you used and gave you 5.
Yes, there's a lot of examples of these rules that is unless the card says differently.
Yeah. And then the second part of that phase is that you spawn monsters into any square that does not have a hero or a monster in it, but does have a monster spawning icon. So very quickly, your map gets filled up with critters.
Yep.
And that's kind of the second phase of the game.
And they don't, like, attack you out of sequence. You only get attacked if you attack them, but you can't leave room so that monsters are
in. Once you're engaged with them, you're engaged with them, and you have to deal with them.
Yeah. All right, so the rule book, a little bit of an organizational mess.
Yeah, you know, it really is. That's all it is. Everything you need to know is in there. It's just not laid out very well. And then it commits the cardinal sin of not having an index.
Moving on next, we get to talk about the awesomeness of components. And this is where this game shines. Now, we've already talked about this a little bit because of that episode where we went through all the minis and talked about them like good radio.
Well, let me start out by saying, you know, Cool Mini or Not always has good box inserts.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of one thing that they're really good at. They make these beautiful thermoform molds that hold all the minis, and it makes it really easy to organize stuff.
And they've done that since the beginning, since Zombicide.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's always been a hallmark of a Cool Mini or Not production. But I do have to say that this game takes it to a whole new level. I mean, this insert that's in here is absolutely phenomenal. In this box, I don't see anything wasted. There's just, it's so well laid out. I love this insert. Card quality is what you would expect. It's on par with anything else Cool Mini or Not. They're decent weight cards with, unfortunately, no linen finish.
The cardboard on the tiles is pretty good. It's not like the first copy of Betrayal I got where they started to warp pretty fast.
Yeah, the tiles are on par with anything we've seen out of Cool Mini or Not before. They come in a couple different sizes. There's small rooms, medium rooms, and 1 large room, which is only used in 1 game mode. The dice are beautiful. They're silk screened and then coated in some kind of clear coat to make them really last. They're going to hold up well.
These are the monster dice.
Yeah, the monster dice. The other dice are kind of standard, again, standard Cool Mini or not dice.
You know, with custom carved out things.
Yeah, and these are the same logos that you see on a lot of the same iconography that you see in Arcadia Quest. You do get a bunch of cheat sheets for every player that are made out of a thinner card stock. I would have liked to have seen this be a little beefier, but there are quite a few of them, so I understand why they went with something a little skinnier.
And these little cheat sheets, they're really good because all of the monsters have different things they do. Like, you know, some of the undead steal a potion off of you if you keep it, or you can't attack them with ranged attacks or whatever. The skeletons, yeah, you can't attack with ranged attacks.
And so these cheat sheets have all the monsters listed. They have the stats on there, easy to read as well, just in case that you don't want to look at the die.
Or you're across the table from the dice.
Yeah. Exactly. They're a really nice way to keep things organized. And then there's also cheat sheets for the bosses as well. And on the back of one of them is a cheat sheet for the Alliance game, which is where you're playing together with your friends rather than against each other. So now let's start to get into kind of just the overall art style leading into the mini discussion. And from an art style perspective, I think what we have here is classic anime tropes.
Yeah, it's the chibi art style. It's the dueling pianos with Super Dungeon Explorer.
Yeah. And it looks good. And I feel like it really kind of fits the mood of backstabbing in the game because it's fun. It's playful. It doesn't take itself too seriously.
Yeah. What the interesting part was, so you've got like all the Masmora odds and ends. So you had a conversion kit where you could take some of the heroes from the original Arcadia Quest and play them in Masmora, which I did purely for testing purposes and not because I wanted to play Paladin. So I played D.Va from the original Arcadia Quest. And it's interesting holding her figure next to one, because you played one of the Kickstarter figures, the Panda Monk.
Yeah.
And
Lang Lang.
It's amazing how much improved the models are. The miniatures in general are much more dynamic. They have a lot more flowy bits, and they in general look cooler. The base game itself comes with five characters. They kind of fit all your fantasy tropes. You know, you got a warrior, you got a wizard, you got a cleric. The cleric's really cool. I like her, actually. I should have played her too. But yeah, if you're looking for one of those games that comes with a ton of figures, this isn't one of them. You just get your selection of heroes, and then the monsters are all dice.
Yeah, but I think it would have driven the price point much higher.
Yes.
Because, you know, this game ends up being $59.99.
It comes with a lot of cards. It comes with the five minis. It comes with a lot of custom dice, which are not cheap.
Well, and Arcadia Quest is a $100 game. So we're talking about a vastly different price point here, and I think it works for this nature of game. Additionally, you know, the other thing that's included in there are cards for all these heroes to go into Arcadia Quest and be playable heroes. So you also get complete compatibility. Anything Masmora marketed, all that stuff can jump right into Arcadia Quest. Everything you need is right in the box, which is awesome.
And then vice versa, they have a conversion kit where you can take the Arcadia Quest stuff and put it in this, which is
And I don't think they're trying to make money off the conversion kit because it's only $8.
And it's a pile of cards.
Yeah. Well, I think what it is their Arcadia Quest came out first, so there really is no way to include everything that you need. It just would drive up the price too much, and not everybody's going to use it. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
$8 for a conversion kit is really, really fair. And with the large cast of characters available in the Arcadia Quest universe, that gives you so much replayability. Did you notice anything off in the execution at all?
No. What this spoke to me was it wanted to be like the rules light version of Arcadia Quest. It wanted to be more of like, say, a party game and not quite as crunchy. It set out to do that and it succeeded. So have you seen anything off in the execution, Jonathan?
No, you know, honestly, I feel like the tableaus for the individual characters could have been a little bit thicker. It's a really, really, really thin card stock. I understand why it's done the way it is, but
honestly, on the table, because you didn't have to pick that up. It was just there to place markers on. It didn't hinder gameplay at all. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like we were moving stuff around so much.
But I can't help but to wish it had something along the lines of the plastic player tableau from Zombicide. And I know that would drive up the price. I totally understand that. But it's just, it's the only thing in the box that doesn't feel as high quality as the rest. So, Robert, now that you've had an opportunity to kind of dive into it and explore the gameplay, tell me about your experience. Was it fun to play? The quintessential question.
Yeah, the game was totally fun to play. Like I said, it played like a rules-light adventure game. And I gotta say, like, the one thing I didn't like about it was when you went in for the finisher at the end of the game where you kicked my butt, it roused my spike side. So if you have a sensitivity to screw your opponent at mechanics and backstabby stuff, this game definitely is playing on the backstabby stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have that problem like I do sometimes. Sometimes you just kind of have to, like, just shove that, put that beast back in the box and beat it back into that.
And that is the nature of the entire Arcadia Quest line. It's all about that backstab. It's PvP.
I was a little worried that, because I was just watching you set the game up, and the setup is kind of involved. You got it down pretty quick, but, like, I think it took you about half as long to set up as it did to play it. Now, if you wanted to do another run, it would be pretty easy because, see, the noob would make the mistake of shuffling everything again. But what you do is you take the tiles that you used and you put them on the bottom of the stack, because we didn't even go through like a third of that stack in our one game. So you can just put all that stuff on the bottom and good luck getting there again.
And to be fair, one of the reasons that we didn't explore as much as we could have is because we were only playing with you and I. When you play with more characters, you explore a lot more, and there's a whole lot less monsters roaming around randomly, which means that it's a little harder to get XP. So the game lasts a little longer.
The game's super fun. It seemed to me like it wanted to be sort of the party game version of Arcadia Quest, and it does it. It does it perfectly.
Yeah.
It gives you everything you need to just have that sort of adventure game experience in one tight little package. There's no campaign. There's no ongoing story. It's just...
And in this respect, it works.
Yeah, it works really well. Yeah, it's a party game. It's fun. It's kind of like... If you're trying to test the waters of a group and see if they are ready or willing to play an adventure game with a little bit more of a story, this is a good way to kind of dip their toe in. You know, it's like this, but you play for like 6 weeks. I would recommend it if you want a lighter adventure game. This is a very light and fluffy and fun adventure game, and I had a great time. Jonathan, fun to play?
Yeah, you know what? I think you encapsulated a lot of my thoughts in yours. It is fun. It's very light. And that's not a bad thing at all. There's a place in your collection for games like this because they are quicker to set up, quicker to play. They don't overstay their welcome. And I think that's certainly the case with Masmora. I love the fact that you'll never see all of the medium-sized rooms in a game because there aren't enough rooms to trigger that.
Yeah, we only had one in our dungeon. And we could have had a second because a second one had popped up, but we didn't
explore. About to come up right at the end.
Yeah.
I also like how well-balanced it is because I played it with multiple player counts, and you take certain tiles out of the game for lower player counts.
Mm.
So you get a very different experience with a lot more of the major monsters as you add additional players to it. And that's kind of interesting because you get put in a position oftentimes where it will behoove people to work together on a monster, but at the same time, you're always just waiting for that opportunity to screw your opponent. Yeah, I think they've really accomplished what they set out to accomplish here. You've got a compact game that's easy to learn, that plays very quickly, and that is non-committal and doesn't overstay its welcome. And I think in that respect, it's a real gem. And that brings us to the end of another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. It's been a pleasure, as always. And Robert, the end of every episode, of course. Any final thoughts that you'd care to share with us?
Yes. Congratulations, listener. You've reached the end of this episode. And like the end of the last episode, that means you were part of a little experiment we are running. What we want you to do is we want you to send us an email to fmdcontest@gmail.com. In the subject line, I want you to put Incorporated Contest. In the meat of the email, put your name and your address and your favorite kaiju movie, just for fun, because we like that stuff. And what you can do is we're going to take all of the submissions from this episode and all of the submissions from last episode. Yes, there's a slightly different thing in the last episode, so you can get two entries. We're going to mash all those names together, and we are going to roll randomly. If there's enough that we can do a die roll. Oh, we should do a die roll.
Oh, totally.
We should do a die roll. If there's enough that we can do a die roll, we will do a die roll if it works out that way. If not, we will probably just use a randomizer off the internet. And somebody, some lucky listener of ours, will get a sealed copy of Kaiju Incorporated, the game that we've reviewed, what, 4 episodes? I don't even know anymore.
Three,
yeah, something like that. So 3 or 4 episodes ago, the game we reviewed. If you are in the U.S., we will pay for shipping. If you are not in the U.S., you will pay for shipping. So keep that in mind if you don't want to pay for shipping. Send your entry to fmdcontest@gmail.com.
Yeah, and I can't really stress enough how likely you are to have a good chance at winning because so few people actually send this stuff in. So if you're even having...
I will put it to you this way. The last time I checked, which given was in the middle of last week, we could use a D6 to randomly roll it. And I'm not saying we had 6 entries because you can also do the D3 with that. So I'm just saying, people, send an email. And if you're one of...
Your chances are good.
And if you're one of the people who did it last time, do it again. When episode 16 hits the airwaves, the contest is over. We will no longer accept submissions after that. So in about 2 weeks, give or take, that'll be the end of it. And we will roll randomly in episode 17, and we will announce the winner on the podcast. And at that point, you're probably going to have to email us again, or we'll email back to you, or whatever. We'll figure it out then. This is our first contest. That's why it's an experiment. That's why it's an experiment. So there you go. Those are my final thoughts. FMDcontest@gmail.com.
Well, as always, join our conversation online. We'd love to hear your opinion on things. And beyond that, Robert, party on.
Party on, Jonathan.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elefiel and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.